He remembered showering with black kids on military bases and watching as his father coached a black semi-pro football team. He remembers money being tight enough that his mom saved the tin foil from a pack of cigarettes. He also remembers the day his mother found that letter, the one addressed to his father and written by a girl in Germany, and the way his mom looked at his father after that. Now she welcomed her son, ecstatic at the development. When Lynn Sr. returned home later that night and learned the news, he was also pleased, for he considered anything resembling stability to be a positive for his son. Then again, he had no idea that his son was on the brink of getting fired from the only real job he'd ever had. The following Monday, Sweet got the news when he returned to school. The school board's official decision, after some debate, was to take no action. He still had a job at Macon High. The question, as he soon learned, was what that job entailed. Jeannie was the one who first noticed the omission, early that fall. If it took a while to notice, it was with good reason. After all, it had been a crazy few weeks. After the wedding, she and Lynn moved in with her parents. Two more grown kids among all the rest, tearing up and down the stairs in the Jesse house. Finally, in late September, their new home arrived. Granted, it wasn't actually a house, but the 70-foot trailer felt like one. Situated in Macon's brand new trailer park, not far from the junior high and the Macon Speedway, it was the perfect size for a young couple. Eventually, the suites filled the trailer with a TV, a yellow beanbag chair, and a coffee table made from a large, upended wooden spool, the kind wire is wrapped around. Beyond that, framing the doorway to the bedroom, hung what was undoubtedly the only bead curtain in Macon. Since Jeannie was student teaching, and Sweet made only $533 a month, money was tight. They'd only been able to purchase the trailer after a friend co-signed the loan, and even then it was an economy model, built by Amish workers in Indiana. Buying anything else was a significant ordeal. Sears turned them down for credit on their first color TV, and it wasn't until their third month together when Jeannie picked up the beanbag chair for $35 on layaway at a Decatur furniture store that the couple was first extended credit. Jeannie teared up when it happened. In Macon, the news of the wedding had come as a surprise to most, as Sweet wasn't one to divulge personal details. However, far from raising eyebrows about a teacher marrying his former student, the union had actually boosted Sweet's reputation around town. At 29, he'd been considered old to still be single in an era when most young men and women married by the time they were 21. And by choosing to settle down with a local girl from a well-respected cornerstone family, Sweet had given locals the first indication that perhaps he finally intended to put down roots and assimilate into Macon. Befitting his cult hero status at the school, a proper announcement was required. So in the fall issue of the Iron Men Scene, the Macon High newspaper, the following ran under the heading of Wedding Woes. It was not difficult to divine who wrote it. In a single-ringed, double-barreled ceremony before thousands at Charleston, Illinois, the former Jeannie E. Jesse eagerly became the new Mrs. L.C. Sweet last September 4th. Featured as soloists at the wedding were Bob Schartzer, singing the Mass in E-flat, and Ernie Miller and his jug band. Attendants to the bride, as of yet unidentified, were resplendently bedecked in a purple chiffon overlacing a delightful sheath of sheer orange burlap and satin that effectively accentuated the lovely pink tennis shoes. The bride looked real good also. Groomsmen in the wedding, reportedly friends of the groom, failed to appear in the ceremony and are being sought by the Acme Tuxedo Rental Company, Champaign, Illinois, 61820. A reception was held for the love-struck newlyweds at the Holiday Inn in Mattoon from 4 to 4:15. After the reception, the couple whisked off to Sigel, Illinois, for their honeymoon, and now make their home at the Arrowhead Trailer Courts, Macon, Illinois, 62544. The former Miss Jessie is practicing teaching at Lakeview High School in Decatur, with plans to graduate in November and begin employment at Wagner Castings. A liberal Democrat, Mr. Sweet is currently anticipating the forthcoming hunting season and has no time for the myriad of coaching and educational honors constantly being heaped upon him. Within weeks of moving into the trailer, Lynn and Jeannie had settled into an easy routine. Sweet handled the social engagements, while Jeannie took care of the business and organizational matters. Naturally, then, it fell to her to file away his teaching contract for the 1970-71 school year. As she did, she read it over again. There was his salary, listed at $6,000, and a list of his duties: English 2 and English 4, junior class advisor, and coordinator of the senior play. There was one missing, however: baseball coach. McClard may not have succeeded in firing Sweet, but he had done the next best thing. 10. Un-American or unpatriotic. Fall inched toward winter. Nixon announced he intended to pull 40,000 troops out of Vietnam by Christmas, four times his original estimate. In October, the Orioles beat the Cincinnati Reds in the first World Series played on artificial turf, while the nation mourned Janis Joplin's death from a heroin overdose. Meanwhile, hopeful Americans signed up by the tens of thousands to join Pan American Airways' waiting list for the first commercial trips to the moon. In Macon, the Ironmen football team finished 6-2, one of the best seasons in school history. In October, Mark Miller and Jane Metzger were named homecoming king and queen. To the cheering of onlookers, the pair rode down Front Street in an open convertible, preceded by cheerleaders, the Macon High Marching Band, and tractors pulling hay racks that students had transformed into floats by painstakingly twisting paper napkins into their chicken wire undercarriages. As the holidays approached, Bill McClard could be seen in his office after school, working feverishly on something, though no one was quite sure what. Basketball season began, and the cold weather moved in. All the while, Sweet remained unconcerned about his contract. No one at Macon High thought much about baseball until after football and basketball anyway. Sweet assumed, perhaps optimistically, that the contract was the result of a clerical error, or perhaps an oversight. At worst, it had to be a bluff by McClard. After all, who in their right mind fired a coach who went 16-2? Then, in early February of 1971, Sweet heard the news. A new history and driver's ed teacher named Dennis Schley was slated to coach baseball that spring. The 22-year-old Schley had been hired the previous summer with the expectation that he would coach junior high basketball and serve as an assistant to Burns on the football team. Though competent and energetic, Schley had never so much as run a baseball practice, let alone presided over an entire season. Now he would be the Ironman's fourth head coach in 4 years. Sweet couldn't believe it. They'd actually done it. He went to Sargent, then McClard, then Britton. From all, he heard the same thing. The board decided it would be best if someone else coached the team. What they really meant, though, was someone who better represented the school. This, Sweet thought, was ridiculous. After the disciplinary meeting, though, it was clear he didn't have much to say in the matter. When word reached the players and parents, they were incensed. Schartzer, being Schartzer, argued they should go straight to the top. "How about I just march into McClard's office," he said, "or Britton's, or Sargent's, or whoever needed to be marched in on." Then Steve would lay it out for them. "If Sweet ain't coming back as coach, you'll need to find a new star pitcher." His dad had half a mind to do some marching in of his own, as did Dwight Glahn. Ernie Miller was ready to bypass the diplomacy and move straight to the ass-kicking. It was Dick Snitker, Brian's father, who prevailed upon them to take a more measured approach. Unlike some of the others, he had a cordial relationship with McClard. Tall and solid, with a wide chin and thinning brown hair, Dick was well-liked and universally respected in Macon. He'd worked for 20 years as Illinois state manager for Pabst before becoming a distributor for Jim Beam, a position that made him quite popular around town and earned Sweet's everlasting respect. A personable, welcoming man, Snitker was also close with Britton, who was the one who had persuaded Snitker to run for the school board the previous fall. Now, in his first term as a board member and secretary, Snitker took his responsibility to the community seriously. And in this case, he felt it important to go through the proper channels. He suggested to the parents that he take down their feelings and those of the boys and present them to the board. Replacing a coach as beloved as Lynn Sweet was no easy feat, and the closer it got to the season, the more second thoughts Schley had. Schley came from a conservative background, and when he looked at Sweet, with the hair and the peace signs, he at first saw someone who looked like he was un-American or unpatriotic. That Sweet had been fired as baseball coach didn't exactly surprise Schley. An assistant during the football season, however, Schley had gotten to know many of the baseball players, and the more he talked to them, the more he wondered about Sweet. The kids spoke of the man so highly and trusted him so completely that Schley figured the strange-looking coach must be doing something right. For his part, Schley's instincts ran closer to Burns, drop the hammer, instill discipline, and he feared that approach would backfire on a team built by Sweet. Then there were the baseball parents. They were nice enough to Schley, and many knew him from football, but it was obvious they wanted Sweet as their coach. This put Schley in a tough spot. Besides, he was worn out. Between teaching and coaching junior high basketball, he was never home. He wanted to spend more time with his new wife, to be home on time for dinner once in a while. 2 weeks before the season, he approached Britton in private and told him he'd be fine not coaching baseball. A few nights later, the Sweets heard a knock on the door of their trailer. Unaccustomed to visitors so late, they ignored it at first, but the knocking persisted. Finally, Lynn turned down the stereo, the one they'd bought on Jack Stringer's credit at Goldblatt's, and walked over to the door of the trailer and peeked out. There on his steps, breath visible in the February night air, stood Bob Glass, the board president. "Hi, Lynn. I'd like to talk to you about something," Glass said. Sweet invited him in. With his square head, bristly flat top, and wide jaw, Glass gave the impression of a man who should have a whistle in his mouth at all times. And indeed, he'd once led the Macon High basketball team to the regionals. Wearing a suit and tie and carrying a clipboard, he looked comically out of place in a trailer that was only a lava lamp away from a college dorm room. Jeannie offered Glass a cup of coffee, and the three of them sat around the small kitchen table. Sweet figured Glass could only be there for one of two reasons: to offer him back the baseball job, or fire him once and for all. Glass wasn't in any hurry to tip his hand, though. Slowly, methodically, he began to interview Sweet. He asked about not returning the uniforms, about team protocol, about meeting school standards, and about Sweet's idea of a proper educational culture. Sweet considered being contrarian and challenging Glass. Had it been McClard in his living room, he might have. Instead, he was cordial and diplomatic. Sweet said that he felt bad about the uniforms, and that he understood that the boys looked up to him, and it probably wasn't the best thing in the world for the players to see their baseball coach rebelling against the school. After 45 minutes, Glass rose, shook Sweet's hand, and left. Watching Glass walk out into the night, Sweet tried to read the man, but failed. For the life of him, he couldn't figure out if this meant he would be coaching again. A week passed, and still nothing. The first baseball practice was 2 days away. Dennis Schley started drawing up a roster. Some of the seniors resigned themselves to yet another new coach. And then, at 7:30 p.m., on the evening of Monday, March 1st, a day before the first practice, the school board convened for another special meeting. After roll call, Dick Snitker stood up. He looked around the table. As usual, all the board members were there. But one man was curiously absent. For reasons Sweet would learn in time, Bill McClard was not in attendance. Not given to digressions, Snitker likely got right to the point. They'd all heard Bob Glass's report. They knew what the parents thought, and they knew what the kids wanted. They knew that while the Ironmen had a chance to be good, there was plenty of work to be done. Work Dennis Schley wasn't qualified for, no matter how nice a guy he was. In the end, it came down to this. Who were they really punishing by firing Sweet? The coach or the players? Then Snitker moved that Lynn Sweet be reinstated as the Macon High baseball coach. For the motion to go to vote, it required a second. Snitker looked around the room. Finally, a hand went up. It was Neil Lentz, whose daughter Terry had taken Sweet's English class when she was Macon High valedictorian in 1969. As the board readied to vote, the men had to weigh a number of factors. There were the words of Snitker and the feelings of the parents and players, but there was also Sweet's track record and reputation, as well as the lingering bad feelings from the previous fall. In essence, what the board needed to decide was whether Sweet had changed. For years, he had been viewed as a renegade, someone who lived in Macon, but was not of Macon. Now, whether the men liked his methods or not, it was clear Sweet was having a positive effect on their children in both the classroom and on the field. Perhaps the vote would have gone differently had McClard been there. Perhaps not. As it was, based on the evidence and the presentation of Snitker, the men were united, as was recorded in the official school board minutes. Upon roll call, it was found that all members voted yea and no member voted nay. The motion carried. Sweet doesn't remember how he found out. Maybe it was Bob Schartzer who called, or Dwight Glann who stopped by, ready to start discussing lineups. Or perhaps Dick Snitker with a bottle of Jim Beam. He does remember the feeling, though. Ever since he'd lost the coaching job, Sweet had been perplexed as to why he was so damn attached to a team no one else wanted to coach. Now he understood that his bond with the Ironmen went far beyond baseball. Given another shot, he intended to further push the boundaries of what was acceptable in coaching. No doubt he'd piss off plenty of people, but, as Sweet saw it, that merely meant what he was doing was working. Yes, he had big plans for this team. Even so, not even Sweet could have imagined what the next season would hold. Part 2. The Forever Season. Prelude. The spring of 1971 dawned as a dark, messy time in America. The economy faltered as unemployment rose and inflation kept pace. Abroad, U.S. troops continued to die in Vietnam, while at home, protests intensified. In March, behind the rallying cry of "Old enough to fight, old enough to vote," the 26th Amendment was introduced, allowing anyone over the age of 18 to vote. Around the country, alternative voices arose. A new radio venture going by the acronym NPR took the air, and an environmental group called Greenpeace was founded. In June, the New York Times published a story called "Vietnam Archive: Pentagon Study Traces 3 Decades of Growing U.S. Involvement," the first in a series that would change the course of American history. In central Illinois, the national pessimism was compounded by local anxieties. Here, in farming country, where 13-year-olds routinely drove tractor loads of grain to be processed, The entire community was in some way dependent upon any given year's crop. Weather was not a matter of small talk, but rather of grave importance. Most everyone worried about it, and with good reason. If local farmers suffered a down season, they spent less money, which meant local businesses suffered, which in turn meant tax collection faltered. In the spring of 1971, what kept farmers up at night was a sweet corn disease called